After sharing Charles Wainwright's critical vision, Fletch felt badly in need of a wash. Taking his complimentary copy of the Boston Star with him, a quarter of the front page was devoted to the bathtub murder of the city council person, Fletch walked up the five flights of stairs which squared the lobby elevator shaft and quietly let himself in the front door of his apartment. Mignon did not bark. After he washed, he went through the front door again, closing it quietly behind him. He pushed the button for the elevator. It creaked up to the sixth floor. He pulled open the iron-grilled doors. They clanged shut on their own weights. After he waited a moment, he rang the bell to apartment 6A. It took another moment for Joan Winslow to collect herself and open the door. "I'm afraid I've locked myself out," Fletch said. "By any chance, do you have a key to 6B? The smell of gin was not stale, but it was mixed with the odor of an air purifier. From beside the skirt of Joan's housecoat, Mignon was looking at him with her usual polite courtesy.
"Who are you?"
Joan asked.
"Peter Fletcher. I'm using Bart's apartment. We met in the elevator yesterday."
"Oh, yes." She lurched heavily on her left foot as she turned to the small hall table.
"You're the man Bart dumped the body on."
"Ma'am?" The drawer of the hall table held many keys.
"The police were here. An enormous man, name of Wynn or something."
"Flynn."
"He spoke so softly I could hardly hear him. Came this morning. Showed me a picture of the murdered girl. I forget her name."
"Ruth Fryer."
"Yes."
She stirred her hand through the key drawer. Fletch said, "Yes?" She pulled out a key with a white tag attached. It read, "Bart's, 6B.
"There it is."
She lurched toward the doorway, apparently thinking Fletch was still standing in it.
"Oh,"
she said, finding him.
"Now use this key and give it right back to me so next time one of you lock yourselves out, I'll have it."
Key in hand, Fletch asked, "Did you let anyone into the apartment Tuesday night?"
"No, of course not. I've never let anyone into that apartment. Except Bart, Lucy, and now you. Anyway, I wasn't here Tuesday night. I had drinks and dinner with some friends."
"Where'd you have drinks?"
"Bullfinch Pub."
She knew she was repeating herself.
"Just up the street."
"I see."
"That's where I saw Bart and the girl."
Fletch crossed the small hall and opened the door to 6B with Joan Winslow's key. Handing it back to her, he asked, "Was the girl you saw with Bart Tuesday night the same girl in the photograph the police showed you?"
"Yes," Joan Winslow said, "of course."
"Did you tell the police that?"
"Certainly, I'd tell anybody that."
She whisked Mignon behind her with the long skirt of her house robe.
"Come in," she said, "it's drinks time."
"Thank you."
"Don't you want a drink?"
"I'll be right with you." Fletch crossed the small elevator landing, closed the door to his apartment, and returned to Jones. He closed the door behind him. Swaying over a well-stocked bar in the living room, her face was that of a child at a soda counter. Her living room was a counterpart of Connors's, in its large size and basic solidity, but far more feminine. Instead of polished leathers and dark woods, the upholstery was white and blue and pink, the furniture light and spindly. The paintings on the walls were originals, imitative modern junk.
"Seeing it's Friday night, shall we have a martini? Why don't you make it?"
She waved her hand airily at the bar.
"Men make martinis so much better than women do."
"Oh, yes." She placed the ice bucket centrally on the service table.
"I'll make crackers and cheese," she said.
She walked flat-footed, placing most of her weight on the heels of her house slippers, prepared at each step to prevent a fall sideways. Joan Winslow was accustomed to being crocked.
"Well..."
On the divan, her legs curled up under her house robe, she bit into a bare cracker.
"Isn't this nice?"
Fletch poured.
"Have you known the Connors as long?"
"Years, ever since they were married. The apartment next door was being prepared for them while they were on their honeymoon, and I was in Nevada getting a divorce. We all arrived back within a day or two of each other and just fell into each other's arms."
"You hadn't known each other before?"
"No, indeed. If I'd laid eyes on Bart Connors before Lucy, she wouldn't have had a chance. He was a darling, and we'd all be much better off." She took the tiniest sip of her martini. Good. Men can make better martinis than women. I used a little vermouth.
You see, what's your name, Peter? That doesn't seem right to me somehow, but I'll use it. They were just getting used to marriage, and I was just getting used to divorce. My husband, a structural engineer, had accepted a contract in Latin America, in Costa Rica, the year before. The poor empty-headed boob remarried there. I found out some months later. I mean, I had no choice but to divorce him, did I? Why put a person in jail just because he's a booby? Don't you think it was the best thing to do?
Absolutely, said Fletch firmly.
Only the Connorses never did get used to marriage.
She drank half her martini in a single swallow.
And I have never gotten used to divorce.
The woman at the most was in her early 40s. She had probably been attractive in a petite, helpless, feminine way. She probably could be again if she would put down her glass.
At first, she continued, it was great fun. They didn't know the building or the district. I got the janitorial service to work for them. There was always something abrasive about Lucy. And found them a string of apartment cleaners. People were doing things for the Connorses because I asked them to. Lucy quite turned people off.
She finished her drink. Fletch did not pour her another.
After a year or two, it was pretty obvious she turned Bart off, too. When I had a dinner party, I usually had the Connorses as guests. They invited me, with or without escort, when they were throwing a bash. What could we do, really? There are only two apartments on this floor, and we were friends. We had to be.
She poured herself a fresh drink.
One night, after they'd been here for dinner, Bart came back. All the other guests had gone. We had a nightcap. A big one. We both had too much to drink. Lucy was frigid, he said, always had been, or so he thought. There was a year of psychiatry for her. During that time, I sort of played psychiatrist for Bart. He'd come over late at night, we'd have a drink and talk. As you can imagine, Lucy became a little cool with me. I could never make out whether it was because I was intimate with the family secrets or because I was getting too much attention from Bart. I can tell you one thing. During all that time, and it went on for a long time, Bart was completely faithful to Lucy. He couldn't have been otherwise without his telling me. I was his good friend, his drinking buddy. Lucy dropped psychiatry after a while. Bart found her another shrink, but she refused to go. You see, I think she discovered what the so-called problem was. Then I noticed a young woman coming in and out of the apartment house, and it sort of puzzled me, as I knew no one had moved in. I saw her during the daytime. Then I realized she was going to 6B. I assumed it was some old friend of Lucy's. Then I met her at a cocktail party at the Connorses. Her name is Marcia Hauptmann. It was announced she and Lucy were starting a boutique together. How nice. All very reasonable. Until the servant we had in common in those days, that was before Mrs. Sawyer, who now comes to me on Tuesdays and Fridays, she just left. And you on Wednesdays and Saturdays. She told me Lucy and Marcia were taking showers together. How else can I say it? They were using the bed together. Incidentally, I fired the person who told me that. Servants must not be allowed to gossip in the neighborhood. And in truth, I had not wanted to know any such thing. Do you believe that?
Of course, Fletch said.
Then I did rather a stupid thing. I thought it was right at the time. I never told Bart. We'd always been strictly honest with each other, but I just couldn't tell him that. I thought the news coming from me would destroy his faith in his own manliness, his own perceptions, if you see what I mean. He had to find out by himself. Instead, I encouraged infidelity.
With you?
I was in love with Bart. Please, would you pour me another touch more?
Fletch poured into her glass.
I'm ashamed to say I did, she said. I'd never been a seductress before, although I'd been seduced enough. I'm afraid I was rather clumsy at it. Bart couldn't understand. He thought of me as a friend of Lucy's. I was his old drinking buddy. Suddenly I turned all hot and passionate. I should say I let him see how hot and passionate I always had been towards him. He rejected me. There's no other way to say that, either. Months went by, no more mutual dinner parties, no more drinking with Bart. I guess finally she told him she was leaving him for another woman. The poor jerk still hadn't caught on.
Fletch said, after Lucy accepted her lesbianism, why did she wait so long before divorcing Bart?
Those adjustments take time, I expect. Maybe she thought it was a momentary thing.
She'd been told she was frigid enough times by Bart and Bart's psychiatrists. I knew that. Here was a person who turned her on. It happened to be another girl. Anyway, Joan continued, Lucy had nothing and Bart is rich. His father built Warder Rand, you know. Bart inherited most of it. Haven't you noticed the paintings in his apartment? You can't buy those with cheesecake. His father ended his days being our ambassador to Australia. I see, Fletch said. But ultimately she did tell him, and she told him the truth. Well, I guess so. Can you realize what that must do to a man? Realize he's been married to a girl who doesn't, well, can't have the slightest interest in him sexually?
She could have.
I'm sure it didn't seem that way to Bart. Every man wants to believe he's married to a red-hot mama who loves him sexually. My husband did. Twice, apparently. To discover your wife prefers girls, to the point where she's leaving you for a girl, can't do much for your ego, no matter how modern you are.
I guess not.
And I'm sure Bart tried to be understanding. He would.
Were the facts of this affair public?
Everyone knew about it, everyone in our circle. That's how I knew the great moment of revelation had come. By that time, you see, neither one of them was talking to me.
He must have felt a little foolish.
Innocent, anyway. Bart, despite his age, was a very innocent man. He went to one of the upcountry colleges, was never in the service, worked like hell through law school, and during his first years at the firm, having to work with Warder Rand simultaneously. His father was dead. When he married Lucy, he was very naive.
He isn't now.
She offered the plate of bear crackers to Fletch. There was no cheese anywhere in sight. He refused them.
So why do you still hate Bart? He asked. Hate him? Did I say I hate him? I suppose I do. After the incident, the revelation, he didn't come to me. I waited politely. Then one day I heard him on the landing. I opened my door and put my arms out to him. I guess I was crying. It was morning. I said, "Oh, Bart, I'm so sorry." I tried to hug him. He took my arms away from around his neck.
He rejected you again.
He even said something rather cutting about my drinking habits. After all the drinks I'd poured nursing him. Something unforgivable.
Fletch said, I expect the poor guy was feeling a little sour on all womanhood at that moment.
It's not that.
Her tears were as big as drops of gin.
He not only rejected me as a woman, that I could understand at the moment. What hurts is that he rejected me as a friend.
I see.
Unabashed, Joan continued talking through her tears, her whole mouth working to get the words out comprehensibly.
Then there was that endless stream of girls who poured through here. Ponytails, frizzy hair, blue jeans, little skirts. It's been going on for months.
Fletch waited for her breathing to become more regular.
So, you think he finally killed one of them?
Of course he did, the bastard.
She flat-heeled over to the serving table and poured herself a slug of straight gin and poured it down her throat.
It wasn't any girl he was killing. Any Ruthie what's-her-name. It was Lucy. He was killing Lucy.
For a moment, Fletch sat, saying nothing. Mignon, sitting on the divan, was looking anxiously at her mistress. Finally, Fletch said,
Is there anything I can do for you? No.
She brushed hair back from her forehead.
I think I'll take a bath and go to bed.
No supper?
I'm too tired.
Fletch dropped her key to Bart's apartment on the coffee table.
We can get a sandwich somewhere. It's early yet.
What about this pub you've mentioned up the street?
Really, she said, I'm much too tired. The police are here this morning about Bart.
I understand. Standing up, he said, Someday I'd like to take Mignon for a nice long walk.
She'd love that.
Joan Winslow showed him to the door. Her face looked dreadful.
Good night.
When he got to his own door, he realized that supposedly he didn't have the key. Her door closed. He shrugged, took his own key out of his pocket, and let himself in. Chapter 20. Fletch was still wondering about the source of his own supper, trying to remember the name of the pub up the street, when his doorbell rang. Oh, my God. The Countess de Grassi was standing among her luggage on the landing. A head with a taxi driver's hat on it was descending down the elevator shaft.
18-20 miles, you say? It's not 18-20 miles.
I said it wasn't. All the time you lie, flesh.
She tried, but not very hard, to pick up one of her suitcases, the biggest.
A nice man let me in downstairs.
Sylvia, what do you think you're doing?
Sylvia could turn an elevator landing into a stage.
You say it's too expensive for me.
Helplessness was expressed by widened eyes, arms thrown wide. Even her cleavage seemed wider.
You right. They present me bill.
Did you pay it?
Of course I pay it. You think the Countess de Grassi some sort of crook? Everybody robbed the Countess de Grassi. The Countess de Grassi robbed no one.
Fletch remained in the center of the doorway.
But why did you come here?
Why do I come here? What do you think? Why should Countess de Grassi stay in too expensive hotel when her son-in-law live around corner in magnificent apartment?
I'm not your son-in-law, ye gods.
To marry Andy, to become my son-in-law, to become member de Grassi family.
Aye, Countess de Grassi.
I've heard. He faltered back a step.
What the hell is this? Son-in-step-law, step-son-in-law, son-in-law-step?
No, no, English double talk in America, please.
Me? Wouldn't think of it. She entered through the small space his body left in the doorway. He closed the door on her luggage.
Very nice.
Her quick glance through the living room door was followed by a quick glance through the den door.
Okay enough. Very nice.
Sylvia, there are other hotels.
Not for the Countess de Grassi. Always number one place. What would poor dead Menti say if Countess de Grassi stay in Fleabag?
I think he'd probably say, thank God I left a lousy estate.
He left no lousy estate. He left magnificent estate. My paintings.
There are more middle-class hotels, Sylvia.
Middle-class? You crazy in the head, you bullshitting son of a bitch. The Countess de Grassi is not middle-class.
I see. She flounced the white gloves in her hands, substituting the action for removing them. They had never been on. It was doubtful they would ever fit over her rather impressive diamond ring.
Now, where my room?
Sylvia, you wouldn't be here just to keep an eye on me, would you?
Eye on you? Devil eye on you!
Her eyes spit into his.
Because honestly, I'm not doing anything about your paintings. I know nothing about your paintings.
Fletch thought a shout would be worth trying.
I'm here researching a book about an American artist, and you'd be in my way.
You bet your cock I'll be in your way.
One should never try to outshout a Brazilian who'd been married to both a Frenchman and an Italian, and who was not middle class.
You no make one move without me. I at the hotel. I might as well be in Rome. In Livorno. I'm not here to buy you a drink and go away again. I'm here to catch my paintings.
Sylvia, I know nothing about your paintings.
Now, where is my room? Servants can bring in the luggage.
Sylvia, there are no servants.
No servants? Always you lie. Who answered your phone the other day? The woman who puts her eyelashes in the refrigerator.
Oh, boy.
The Countess de Grassi marched down the corridor to the bedrooms, snapping on lights as she went. While Fletch was still in the reception hall, the telephone rang. He answered it in the den.
Hello, Mr. Fletcher?
Yeah.
This is Mr. Horan of the Horan Gallery.
Oh, yes.
Sorry to bother you on a Friday night, especially after 7, but I thought you'd be pleased to hear my good news.
Oh?
Yes, I've succeeded in locating the painting you were interested in. Picasso's Vino Viola Mademoiselle.
That's wonderful.
I've talked with the present owner. Like the rest of us, I guess he's suffering somewhat from a shortage of cash, and I think he was rather pleased that someone has come forward at this time with an interest in buying it. I suggested to him that as you had sought the painting out, he might get a slightly higher price than if he were simply to offer it on the market himself, now or in the near future.
I hope you didn't make his mouth water too much.
No, no, simply a negotiating device. But of course a seller does do better when a negotiation is initiated by the buyer, you do understand.
Of course.
He does slightly better. If, after we see the painting, you are still interested in its purchase, I will do my best to get it for you at the most reasonable price.
Tell me, Mr. Horan, where is the painting?
There was a hesitation on the phone.
Who is its present owner?
Well, I don't usually like to answer that question. I'm a private dealer.
Fletch said nothing.
Horan said, I guess there's no reason why I shouldn't answer you in this instance. The painting is owned by a man named Cooney in Dallas, Texas.
Texas? Texas is still big in the art market, eh?
There are some superb private collections in Texas. Mr. Cooney has not been an active collector, to my knowledge, but he does have this piece and some others I know of. The Barclay Bank in Nassau has given you a credit reference more than adequate. Therefore, I have asked Mr. Cooney to fly the painting up for our inspection. It should be here by morning. The painting is coming here? It should already be on its way. I tried to get you by phone this afternoon. Truth is, I had to spend considerable time advising Mr. Cooney on the work's proper crating and insurance.
I'm very surprised the picture is coming here.
Well, I want to see it myself. If it's authentic, I might want to purchase it myself or find another purchaser for it, should you decide not to purchase it. Once an owner gets over what might be called a psychological hump and makes the basic decision that he might consider selling an object of art, if the price is right, as our Mr. Cooney did this afternoon after lunch in Dallas, then a dealer should go forward with him and arrange a sale. You did all this by telephone?
Oh, yes, I'm not unknown in Texas.
Well, that's wonderful. What else can you tell me about Mr. Cooney?
Not much. I was put on to him by a curator, a friend of mine at the Dallas Museum. My source knew Cooney owned a Picasso of your general description, but had never seen it. I called Mr. Cooney last night and asked him bluntly if he owned a Picasso entitled Vino Viola Mademoiselle, an impossible title. I gather he dropped his bourbon bottle. He answered in the affirmative. I said I might have a purchaser for it. He thought about it overnight. I believe he's in ranching, has something like 8 children.
That's why he needs some cash, right?
In any case, Mr. Fletcher, albeit tomorrow is Saturday, I believe if you came here, is 9:30 too early? We could look at the painting together and perhaps make Mr. Cooney an offer before the bourbon begins to flow again.
Yes, that would be fine. You say the painting is coming by air tonight?
Yes, if all goes well. If it's not here in the morning, I'll give you a ring, but I'm sure it will be here.
Fletch said, Okay, I'll see you in the morning.
Sylvia stood in the doorway to the den.
You'll see who in the morning?
At least she'd not been listening on the extension. I have to see a man about a horse.
A Degas horse?
No, Sylvia, a pinto.
What is this pinto horse? A painted horse, right?
Now, in a more kittenish manner, she sat on one of the leather chairs.
What about my dinner?
She said.
What about it?
No servants. Don't you expect me to eat flesh? I'm your guest.
Right, Fletch said. You've never tasted my cooking, have you?
You cook?
Like a dream.
He kissed the tips of his fingers and exploded them before his face.
Better than the Ritz. Let's see.
Thoughtfully, he paced the small room.
To begin with, a potage au croissant, yes? Timbales de foie de volaille, good. Homard à l'américaine. Then, of course, a fricassé de poulet à l'indienne. With pois frais en braisage. What could be better, eh? For dessert, Charlotte Chantilly aux framboises. Splendid.
He considered her anxiously.
Would that be all right, you think, Countess?
It sounds all right.
Of course, it will take me some time.
I'm used to eating late. I want to see these things you cook.
I'd offer you a drink, but of course, I never would before such a dinner.
Of course not. I'll take nothing to drink.
You sit right here. I'll get busy in the kitchen.
Briskly, Fletch crossed the reception hall and went through the swing door to the kitchen. He also went through the kitchen, out its back door, and down the stairs to the alley. He ran to the garage on River Street. Not taking time to figure out a new route to 60 Newbury Street, he drove down Beacon Street, past his own apartment. The two plainclothesmen in the parked car across from 152 Beacon Street looked like bags of laundry. But they had their eyes firmly on the front door of the apartment house. Fletch scratched his left temple while passing them. He turned left on Arlington Street and right on Newbury. Double parking outside a pharmacy, he ran in and ordered 2 sandwiches and some soft drinks to go. He also ordered 2 cups of coffee. There was a place to park diagonally across the street from the Horan Gallery. He turned off his lights and engine and settled down to wait. It was then he realized he would need more than his suit jacket. He was cold. Within 20 minutes, the garage doors at 60 Newbury Street opened. Fletch saw the grill of a Rolls-Royce with its headlights on. The 60-year-old houseman, or gallery assistant, or whatever he was, closed the doors after the Rolls pulled out. There was only one way the Rolls could go on Newbury Street, it being a one-way west, and the car went west. In the van, Fletch followed Horan in the Rolls. They went by several cross streets.
They went west to the end of Newbury Street. After stopping at a red light, they crossed Massachusetts Avenue and dipped down a ramp onto the Massachusetts Turnpike Extension and kept going west. The Rolls proceeded at a stately 55 miles per hour. It went through a toll booth, making its proper genuflection to the exact change machine, and continued westward. It curved right before the second toll booth. Weston, Fletch read. 128 North South. At the end of the off-ramp, there was another toll booth. In his own lane, Fletch caught up to Horan. He waited a moment before throwing change out the window, as if he were having trouble finding the exact change. The Rolls preceded him onto the Weston Road. After stopping at a light, the two vehicles veered right. The road from there curved and climbed gently, past woods, a golf course, well-spaced antique farmhouses, and more contemporary estate houses. Fletch dared not let the Rolls' taillights get more than 150 meters ahead of him. Even that was almost too much on that road. After a curve, the taillights were no longer ahead of him. Slowing imperceptibly, Fletch saw a car going through woods down a driveway to his left. The headlights were huge and round, the shape of the car boxy, the taillights huge. It had to be the Rolls. Fletch drove around the next curve and pulled over. He left his parking lights on. He ran along the soft shoulder of the road back to the driveway he thought Horan had taken. The mailbox read Miller. Lights in a house further down to his left went on. The mailbox on that driveway read Horan. Stepping around in the dark, he explored the area across from the driveway. There was a break in the stone wall with a rusty chain across it. The wall was only 2 meters from the road. Fletch returned to his truck and turned it around. Before reversing to put the back bumper of his truck against the chain, he turned out its headlights. The chain snapped easily. Crunching through brush, Fletch backed up, turned the wheel, and then drove forward to the wall. Through a light screen of brush in front of him, he had a perfect view of the Horan driveway. In the silent dark, he had one sandwich and a cup of coffee. He watched the lights go out in the Horan house. At 11:45, all the lights were out in the neighbor's house. At 1:30, Fletch walked up the shoulder of Horan's gravel driveway. Moonlight came and went through the clouds. After a patch of woods, a lawn appeared to the left in front of the house. It had two levels. The upper level apparently was used as a patio. Under a green striped awning, white wrought iron furniture remained outdoors in October. The house was a rather imposing three-storied structure. Its slate roof reflected moonlight. Going around the right of the house, Fletch had to cross a patch of gravel. He took off his shoes to do so. A garage was connected to the house. Around the garage ran a dirt car track to an unused three-sided tractor shed. The extensive gardens at the back of the house had fallen into decay. He examined the windows at the back of the house. All, including the windows and the kitchen door, were wired with a burglar alarm system. Woods came up to the far side of the house. Fletch returned to his van and had his second sandwich and the cold coffee. By 3:30, he was cold enough to look in the back of the van for something to wrap around himself, although he was sure there was nothing there. In fact, the painters had left a long piece of tarpaulin. The splattered paint on it was dry to the touch. Returning to the driver's seat, he wrapped the tarpaulin around him. He was getting comfortably warm when dawn arrived.